Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Amitav Ghosh, whose latest book is River of Smoke. This is the second book in the Ibis trilogy. The first book was Sea of Poppies. Other books include The Hungry Tide, The Glass Palace. There are 7 novels and 5 books of nonfiction by Amitav Ghosh. He was born in Calcutta in 1956, grew up in India, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, and now lives part of the time in New York and part of the time when he's writing in Goa. I noticed on your blog you have photos of both Occupy Seattle and Occupy Wall Street. Are you planning to go to as many Occupies as you can?
Yes. In fact, it's a sort of interesting thing to do when you're on a book tour, I think. You know, one thing I found is that they're all great readers. And that's a sort of very encouraging thing for me, because especially at the Occupy Wall Street when I went there, you would see novels everywhere, Penguin classics, modern novels, and it was wonderful to see that. I think a lot of them are sort of like young people who've been very highly educated or who are extremely intelligent and, you know, reading a lot and so on. I remember 2 years ago when there were those huge sort of riots and uprisings in Greece. I remember thinking then that something very, very strange is happening and that it's not the end, but it's the beginning. And sure enough, you know, from there it went to Italy, then it went across to Tunisia. And, you know, I've spent time in Tunisia. Tunisia is a place that's very closely connected to Europe, you know, economically and in every other, culturally and so on. So basically it did an entire round of the Mediterranean, and now, you know, it's in America. You know, what's so interesting about going to the Occupy protests is that it looks very disorganized, but in fact, once you look around, it's actually very, very well organized. And it's not the kind of organization that springs up overnight. So you can sense that, you know, the people who are involved in it were prepared and they know what they're doing.
Let's talk a little about your books, Amitav Ghosh, the Ibis trilogy, because as I read the books, they struck me as almost Dickensian. How deliberate was that? There's a lot of coincidence going on. Characters come back from thousands of miles away all the time. They meet up with each other. And it seems that you're attempting a certain kind of epic here.
Well, Dickensian. Well, I loved reading Dickens, but I haven't read him in a very long time. But yes, many people say that. You know, that's fine with me. Coincidences. You know, I'm very interested in coincidences. Because if you think about it, what is a coincidence? It's an improbable event, right? So it's essentially something which you're positing against the notion of probability. I just don't know if I believe in probability so much.
I've talked to authors who have said that one of the difficulties with trying to deal with fiction as you would in real life is that these kinds of coincidences, strange meetings, happen all the time. And yet if we put them in a book, they seem manipulative, but in real life they actually happen.
Of course. I mean, you look at what life is. Life is a series of improbable events. I mean, it's true for everyone. I mean, how did I meet my wife? She was on the other side of the world. I mean, I was in India, she was in New York, but somehow we met. I really do think that life is a series of improbable events. Of course, there are long periods when nothing improbable happens. But in fact, anyone who narrates their life goes from, you know, the high points or the low points. I mean, it's all these improbable events strung together. So it's only natural that in narration, there should be, because why are we going to narrate all the dull days when everyone gets out of bed and, you know, that's just not how a story works.
Your previous book before these two was The Hungry Tide, which was contemporary. And then you decided to go back to the 1830s and the prequel to the Opium Wars. What was your intention? Where did you begin? Did you know it would be a trilogy when you started Sea of Poppies?
I knew it would be a trilogy when I was about a few months into writing Sea of Poppies, because I found the characters so compelling and I found the story itself so so interesting that I knew I would be with it for a very long time. Besides, you know, the other thing is that as a novelist, you get used to this whole sort of rhythm of, you know, you reach the end of a book and you say goodbye to those characters. And it's kind of really wrenching, you know. I mean, when you just leave all those characters who you've lived with, you know, and who become a part of yourself. And I did think to myself that, you know, I just can't stand that anymore. I mean, I just have to lived with these characters for a very long time, and that's basically what I'm doing.
Well, it seemed as I was reading River of Smoke, there seemed to be a reason, which was the political reason leading up to the Opium Wars. Anytime you're writing about the past, there are resonances with today, but the resonances in River of Smoke become very clear, which we'll go into in a few minutes. But it seemed that you had a goal, that you were shooting for something, but in fact you were just telling the story of the people on the Ibis when you began.
Yes, absolutely. No, the resonances completely emerged out of the material. I wasn't looking for them. But in fact, if you look at the material, the resonances are inescapable. They're just there. Because, you see, the Opium War was the first war that was fought in the name of free trade. And since then, there have been many such wars. And, you know, in some way, even the rhetoric that surrounded the Opium Wars was so eerily like the rhetoric that surrounds Iraq. To the extent where people, merchants, were actually saying things like, oh, they'll be cheering on the streets of Canton when you walk in. The resonance is just staring you in the face.
And, of course, now with all the demonstrations and the anger at the banking industry and the financial world, I could see the discussion of free trade moving into another area as I was reading Bahram's rants about free trade and the free trade in the chamber. Suddenly it wasn't just about opium or resonances with Iraq, but resonances with what the financial industry did.
You know, that's one of the reasons why I find it so interesting to go to these, to visit these Occupy movements, because the curious thing is that even within the last 10 years, we've had so many policymakers and politicians and important people constantly talking to us about free trade and how important it is and how good it is. And it just amazes me that they seem to assume that free trade has no history. You know, this is an idea which was behind the opium trade, over which wars have been fought, and people still talk of it as though it was sort of a morally neutral and a sort of wonderful thing which is just going to bring glory and peace to mankind. And I just think, how do they get away with it? How is it that nobody ever points out that, you know, it was in the name of free trade that the drug trade came into being?
If you want to talk about the amnesia of America or people in the world, I think that from generation to generation that goes on. I'm pretty well educated, and yet my knowledge of the Opium Wars was minimal until I read River of Smoke and realized that here not only did Britain deliberately destroy the crops of India in order to plant poppies, but then they deliberately destroyed the population of China in order to make money on opium, and then went to war over it. It's astonishing.
It's an absolutely astonishing thing. Truly it is. And, you know, I'm from India, which was, in some sense, one of the major players in this. And in India, nobody is taught about it. No one knows about it. It's a complete sort of black hole in our history. And it's an astonishing thing, as you say. I mean, I'm sure even today, if you walk into a classroom in Berkeley, into any sort of ordinary undergraduate classroom and take 100 undergraduates and ask them what was the Opium War, the answer will probably be that the Opium War was China was waging war against the West in order to force opium on the West. But in fact, it was exactly the other way around, you know. I mean, the degree to which this whole subject is elided and occluded, it's an astonishing thing.
We see elements in what Britain did, certainly in the way they destroyed civilizations through their colonialism anyway.
After having looked at this history and having looked at a lot of history for a long time, I tend to take a rather dim view of history in general. And I think, the idea that history somehow leads to something better is kind of a very misleading idea, and that in general things just go from bad to worse. Or, you know, perhaps any group of people who had their power and who had their abilities would have done what they did. That doesn't really surprise me so much. What does surprise me, though, is that we don't question it when we are told that, you know, these acts were beneficial acts, or that somehow the world benefited from them. I mean, there's a whole sort of, how shall I say, a whitewashing of this aspect of the past.
Amitav Ghosh, getting back specifically, let's talk first about Sea of Poppies. Now, the two books can be read separately, but the second book, there are so many resonances that go back to the first book that even though one is more of a sea adventure and the second one is more of the tale of politics in Canton, they are one story. And I would gather that the third story continues with some of the characters from the first. But let's go back to Sea of Poppies. When you began You started with the character of Diti?
Yes.
How much had you figured out at that point? I know that in 2005 you learned to sail, so obviously you knew she was going to wind up on a boat.
Oh, yes, yes. I mean, Diti's character is one of the first to come to me. And really what I was thinking of writing there was the story of, a group of people and especially a woman leaving India. I wouldn't personally have said that it's a sea story. It's more a sort of story of how this particular group leaves, you know. The idea for it is actually very simple. It's that there's a number of people on a ship that's leaving India, going into the indenture, and there were thousands of such ships. So I just wanted to trace their histories back.
And what you did is you created several characters, Didi, Zachary Reed, Paulette, Jodu, Neil, of course, who starts out as a Raja. These characters all are separate, but as we read the book, we know they're going to eventually come together, sort of like the Fellowship of the Ring.
Well, I would say it's more like, I don't know if you ever read Thornton Wilder's Bridge Over St. Louis, Ray. It's a wonderful, wonderful book, which I read when I was in my teens, and it had a very powerful impact on me. The story is very simple, really. It's about this bridge in Peru, in 17th century Peru. And one day the bridge breaks, and there are six people on the bridge. They all die. And he traces each individual history. We were talking about the probable and the improbable. In a sense, it's so improbable that these particular six people should be on the bridge. But on the other hand, if you look at any accident, anybody who's in it is improbably there. So in a sense, that was the sort of motif for me that, you know, if you walk out on the street and look at a bus, the particular group of people who are on it, what brought them there? What was the trajectory? And that in itself becomes a narrative, you know. I mean, the ship itself becomes a narrative that carries you.
I know that in River of Smoke, you've said that one character, Bahram, kind of took over the book unbeknownst to you. Was there any character in Sea of Poppies that took over in the same way, that was going to be a minor character and suddenly the voice just shouted at you?
Yes, absolutely. In Sea of Poppies, it was Diti. I mean, even though Diti was, from the beginning, a major character, she really became, as it were, the mast that carried the book forward. I mean, she was, she just became a very, very important figure in the book, much more than I had anticipated. In a way, one can't really anticipate these things.
When you're writing, do you have an ending in mind? Did you know the ending early on and then just find the path there, or was it all kind of obscured by mist?
Good God, I don't even usually know the end of the chapter. Yes, obscured by mist is very well put. No, for me, writing is the journey. I don't know how the journey ends until I've been on it.
That requires a huge amount of research, particularly the scenes on the ship with the Lascars speaking a kind of pidgin, which you don't translate, and unless there's a little bit of a glossary in the back of the book, but that doesn't necessarily help you out. We have to figure out what they're saying in context, which I found really fascinating.
Well, absolutely. But then if you think about it, when you read Melville, and Melville uses a word like, say, mizzenmast, do you know what a mizzenmast is?
No.
And I'm sure half the people, you know, who read Melville, I should think 1% of a reading population knows what a mizzenmast is. So, you see, I found myself in this position of I use words, English words, which nobody knows, or I use Lascari words, which nobody knows. So how does it matter?
I mean, you could have been making this up and I couldn't tell, but I assume this is a real language that they're speaking, each sentence.
Yes, and I'll tell you how it came about. If you know anything about sailing, one of the things that's interesting about sailing is that it's a technology that's crucially dependent on language. Because what happens on a sail ship is that, you know, an officer calls out an order and, like, you know, 100 people have to obey instantly. Now, the sail ships off the Indian Ocean were incredibly varied. You know, there were people from China and India and, you know, on the crew. So I wondered to myself, how did this work? I mean, in what language was the officer speaking his commands? And I thought to myself, there must be a dictionary because, all the major nautical languages have dictionaries. So I started looking, and sure enough, I found a dictionary. It was called the Lascari Dictionary.
From 1812?
From 1812, yes. And it was published in Calcutta. So there I was. I mean, you know, I had this dictionary, and it provided all the material I needed. So, yes, it's a real language. It existed. People spoke it. But once the technology disappeared, so did the language.
What it does is it puts you there in a way, I think, because the language itself becomes almost like part of the atmosphere.
Exactly, exactly. As writers, for us, words serve many functions other than that of merely communicating information. Words conjure an atmosphere, they conjure a sense of place, they conjure a sense of time. The words in the book do all those things. They locate you in a certain place, they give you a sense of why this place is different from your ordinary reality.
When you were bringing all these characters together from disparate elements, were there moments when you said to yourself, oh my God, how the hell am I going to do this?
Yes, absolutely. If we'd been talking about River of Smoke 10 months ago, I would have thought to myself, how the hell am I going to finish this book? It just seemed a very improbable thing to have so many lives intersecting. But on the other hand, you know, you look at the crew list and the passenger list of any 19th century ship, and it's just the same. There are all these people from just completely divergent parts of the world, and they're suddenly there on this ship.
Well, you knew you had to get Paulette, this French woman, on board the boat. Was that one of the more difficult puzzles to figure out?
No, it wasn't really, because, you know, Paulette is, to my mind, someone who's very good at passing, you know, for various different things. She has all these languages. She's able to dress herself up in certain ways. And that's the kind of figure that really interests me, you know. So I knew she would be good at it.
Well, you've been around Calcutta. If one were to go to Calcutta, are there any places, anything that looks even remotely like it did in the late 1830s?
Calcutta is a city that actually, perhaps more than most other cities, has actually got a lot of the 19th century past left. The old opium exchange building is still there. Many of the old opium warehouses are still there. You'd be able to see a lot.
And the character of Burnham, the man who owns the Ibis, is he based on anybody?
Not on any one particular person, no.
Amitav Ghosh, Sea of Poppies ends, in my mind, it ends sort of like the end of The Empire Strikes Back, where Han Solo goes off one way and there's Luke and Leia. And in this case, we have a boat filled with four passengers and then the ship with our three remaining main characters. Did you think you would continue the cliffhanger at that point, or did you know you were going to go in a somewhat different direction?
You know, there's something very mysterious about books in my experience. And when they end in your head, you can't push them. You know, I would have liked to push Sea of Poppies beyond where it ended, but I couldn't. I just didn't know. I mean, it really seriously ended for me there. And I felt that the book had this narrative arc. It begins with Aditi seeing Zachary, and it ends with Aditi seeing Zachary. And to me, that was the sort of narrative arc of the book. I didn't know what would happen after that. You know, writing a trilogy is no different from writing three separate books. I mean, each book is its own challenge. It's its own world. You have to do it on its own terms.
At the end of Sea of Poppies is The Chrestomathy by a character named Neil. At that point, we find out that Neil actually will survive to write this, which means you were giving something away. There seems to be, inside that particular section of the book, a hint that this man is the author's distant relation.
You know, all I can say about that is that I feel like Neil is my distant ancestor. You know, I don't know why I should, but I just feel he is. And the longer I live with him and the longer I live with these books, it's really become a kind of a profound conviction. I mean, I feel that, you know, even if he wasn't my ancestor, I've made him my ancestor. The Chrestomathy was something I did just to entertain myself, really. I mean, it was after I finished Sea of Poppies, and it's not a glossary in any sense, really. It doesn't actually gloss the words. The glosses that it provides, the idea of it is that it leads you back into the book. Because I actually don't believe that words can be defined, you know. I think the whole business of meaning is an infinite regress in some sense. It wasn't meant to be a glossary at all. It was just something I did to entertain myself, and then you know, the editor liked it and wanted to include it in this, and they did. But it's not included in the Indian edition nor in the UK edition.
There is mention of it,
yes,
in River of Smoke,
yes,
however.
There is. Yes.
So you pick up River of Smoke, and in River of Smoke, we find out kind of what happened to some of the characters, but we only follow Paulette and Neil among the major characters in the first book, and we meet this character of Bahram, who is an Indian opium trader. Is he based on anybody in particular?
He's, again, not based on any one person, but in that period and in that time, there were several such traders traveling between Bombay and Canton, several traders who made enormous sums of money, and several of them were present in Canton at the exact time when these things were happening.
The book opens in Mauritius. Have you visited there?
Yes, of course. Yes.
What's it like?
Mauritius is a completely wonderful place. It's this incredibly beautiful island. You know, it's a peaceful, gentle place. I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed meeting the people from Mauritius because so many of them are descendants of, you know, Indian indentured workers. And they've developed a sort of culture of their own, which is kind of very interesting, very lively, a sort of island culture of singing and, you know, of merrymaking. It's a wonderful place.
Canton itself, have you been to Canton?
Yes, I spent a lot of time. I'd never been to, it's of course Guangzhou. I'd never been there before I wrote Sea of Poppies. But I first went there, you know, when I was beginning to write Sea of Poppies, and I spent about a month there. And since then, I've been back several times.
At that point, as you were doing your research, you knew that River of Smoke would mostly be set there?
No, I didn't. I didn't. I just wanted to go and see, you know, what was, as it were, the end point of the opium that was coming out of India.
In writing the book, obviously, you did a lot of research and learned a great deal. What was the most startling fact that you didn't know about that entire period?
Oh, I don't think I could put down one. The single most startling thing was, I think, just to discover how large a part of the world economy opium was, how much of international trade it accounted for, because these things are not spoken of. But then around that, you discover so many other things. I mean, it was astonishing to me to discover, for example, that Franklin Delano Roosevelt's grandfather was one of the biggest traders in Canton, Andrew Delano. That was where their family fortunes were made. The Coolidge family was hugely involved. You know, Washington Irving, the great American writer, his nephews were in Canton trading in opium, and he himself was speculating in opium.
The town, the funky town, which is all men, Indian and Caucasian, was very gay. Did you have any idea that you would discover that?
Once I started reading the letters and the journals and so on, it was so campy. I mean, there was such a sort of campy aspect to it, you know. You know, all that stuff that's in the book about those dances, you know, all of it is true. I mean, it's just straight from the sources. I mean, these men, you know, they had to live there 6 months of the year without families. So it was a place that was attractive to, you know, lifelong bachelors. And most of them were lifelong bachelors, you know, and they loved living there. They hated having to go away. They were terrified of women. Once, you know, three women came from Macau. One of them was American and two English women. They came from Macau, and when they left, all the old bachelors were standing on the riverside, and they recorded as having said to each other, "May that never, ever happen again."
You have a character called Slade calling them Bulgarians. Is that actually a term, or was that your invention?
Well, that was my invention, because, of course, there was no conception, as it were, of, you know, same-sex relationships at that point. I mean, at least not in that way. But the word bugger does come from bulgar. So there's a direct connection, if you like.
In an interview, you said that Bahram kind of grew in a way, and his voice kind of grew in a way you wouldn't have expected. But it seemed to me, in reading the book, that the character whose voice you enjoyed writing the most was Robin.
I really did enjoy writing Robin, yes. It was really, really fun. Through this entire period in the 1830s, there were lots of letters, and I read lots and lots of letters, some of them in manuscript, some published. But there was one particular letter writer. Her name was Harriet Lowe, and she was actually from Brooklyn, and she lived in Macau. And she wrote all these letters back from China. And they're wonderful letters, and written in this very lively sort of voice. And I suppose just reading so many letters, you know, that voice sort of was in my head, you know. I just really so much enjoyed writing this kind of sort of a sort of Victorian voice, which is filled with innuendo and with, you know.
Did you have any idea when you began the book that half the book or a third of the book would be these letters from a flamboyant Indian English painter?
No, I mean, he was always going to be a character. But that his letters were going to become so much a part of it, no, I had no idea of that. And in fact, you know, it was only very, very late in the book last year, and I mean late last year, in fact, that I started writing the letters.
Had you originally just intended that to be more third-person POV?
Yes. But, you know, the letters were the perfect thing, really, because apart from everything else, they create a sense of immediacy. You know, you actually place someone right there. Then you're playing, you know, two rhythms against each other, two temporal rhythms against each other.
What I noticed is he would mention someone parenthetically that he barely knew, and then we would cut back to Bahram or Neil or even another character, Zadig, who is a point-of-view character occasionally. He's a friend of the Indian opium trader Bahram. And we get a completely different feel of who they are and how they interrelate.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, it's, you know, it's refractions. Because in River of Smoke, I follow the events very, very closely. In a sense, it has to be a sort of very tight and disciplined narrative, you know. I'm sure to many readers it will seem that I'm sort of wandering and so on. But it's not like that at all, actually. It's extremely tightly knit.
Are the other characters, Slade, Dent, William King, are these real people?
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, in this book, a lot of the words they speak are their own words.
So the scenes in the chamber when they're discussing opium and its relationship to China and their own free trade, that is more history than novel.
It's completely taken from, you know, from the sources. They were Victorian, so they recorded everything that was said, you know. So we actually have, I mean, in some places, there are actual exchanges. John Slade was the editor of the Canton Register, so we know exactly what he was saying. And it's a very powerful voice, you know. Absolutely a sort of blowhard voice, you know, a kind of voice of a neocon, like an early neocon. And I loved that, you know, it was just so much fun to be just seeing this neocon. See, the sources give you the words often, but what it doesn't give you is the intrigues, the motivations, you know, what lies behind the voice. So the more you look at the sources, the more puzzling it seems. Why is this guy changing his mind today? Why is this guy going along with him now? What are the interior connections? So that's how, you know, the narrative comes into being, as it were.
At the very end of the book, there's a comment that without one or two paintings, no one would know this strange enclave of foreigners would exist. What kind of history do we have of that enclave? Do we have pictures? I mean, it was pre-photography, but do we have paintings of what that area was like?
There's an incredibly rich visual record.
Really?
Incredibly rich, because as you've seen in River of Smoke, Canton was many things, which is what makes it so interesting. But one of the things it most powerfully was is that it was this incredible factory of image-making. You know, they had these huge studios where they were just producing images, you know, of ships, portraits of seamen, portraits of George Washington, and then also extremely good paintings. So it was sending into the world this incredible number of images. In most American houses, you know, especially in the Northeast, if you go in, you'll see some pictures of ancestors. Almost certainly most of those were painted in Canton. You know, because a sailor would go, he would take a miniature, he would hand it to a Chinese painter, and the Chinese painter would, you know, would blow it up into a full-sized painting. Don't forget that in those days it was very hard, you know, it was expensive to get portraits. You know, they painted a Canton, they had this whole industry of creating souvenirs. The visual record is incredibly rich, and if you want to have a look at it, go to www.ibistrilogy.com. There's a whole set of paintings up there.
This seemed to be the origin of postcards?
Yes, I think it was. I can't prove it, but that's my suspicion, yes.
Now, I also understood that when they took these paintings, these miniatures, and they put them on dishes, that's how we came up with fine china, because it came from China.
Of course. I mean, the whole porcelain industry came from China. That's the interesting thing about Canton Studios. In fact, they were not artists in the sense in which, you know, one thinks of high art. They were mainly porcelain painters, you know, because what China did historically is that, you know, the Dutch would go there and the Dutch would tell them, we want this design. And the Chinese would just provide that design. And the curious thing is that the Dutch would then go back to Holland and say, this is chinoiserie, you know, whereas in fact it was their own design.
And of course the word cash came from that time too.
Yes, the cash is actually a Sanskrit-derived word. I forget exactly where it's from, but yes, I mean, it was very much one of the money words used in Canton.
Amitav Ghosh, a lot of the book is about the politics of the era. along with free trade and the arguments in favor of it, and of course they're not just talking free trade, they're talking free trade of one of the most powerful drugs on the planet, and they're treating it as if it's just commerce. Were you stunned at all by that? Were you surprised, or by the end had you almost become deadened to it?
You're absolutely right. I mean, in the beginning, one is astonished and appalled. And then as it goes on, you realize you do become, in a way, deadened. Because actually, you know, the opium trade is responsible for creating so much of the world as we know it, that it's actually inseparable from our existence. I mean, you know, four of the biggest, most important ports of the world today wouldn't exist if it were not for the opium trade. Bombay, Singapore, Hong Kong, Shanghai, all of these are in one way or the other connected with the flourishing of the opium trade.
In an interview, you said that opium is the basis of mass corruption, and it seems to me that you can start there, but then you can see the theme repeated again in prohibition in the United States and repeated today in the way the drug wars are carried out. It hasn't changed.
It hasn't changed at all. I quote in this book Charles King, who was a real character. He was an American who at that time was one of the very few people who was very actively opposing the opium trade. And he wrote this very powerful letter to the British authorities where he says, beware what you're doing, because one day this will come back to haunt you. You know, this mass addiction will spread to your own countries. And what will you do then? See, the only country that has ever successfully tackled the issue of mass addiction is China. And they did it even before the revolution. It was in the 1920s when they managed to finally put an end to the export of opium through the Geneva Conventions.
There's a meeting between Bahram and Zadig with Napoleon. You mentioned that was a real meeting. Who was at that real meeting?
While I was doing research at the National Maritime Museum in London, I came across a very detailed journal by a guy called William Kershaw. He was an Englishman who was trading in Canton, and he was on his way from Canton to London, and he stopped in St. Helena. And, you know, it's exactly as I described. He met Napoleon. Napoleon questioned him in great detail about Canton, about opium, and so on.
So you were able to just simply incorporate it.
Yes, if you like.
What kind of serendipities in writing either of these books did you find? Kind of a way out of a puzzle, and you're just reading something and you go, there's the answer.
Oh, it happened all the time. I mean, you know, I would start reading and, you know, I mean, just as I described with the Lascari Dictionary, I had an intuition that such a thing must exist. And then suddenly one day there it was.
The ship in River of Smoke, Anahita, is that based on a real ship?
Yes, the big Bombay shipyards were making some of the best ships in the world and some of the most luxurious ships in the world. The Anahita had her antecedents.
Have you been on a ship like that?
No, none of them exist anymore.
Really?
Yeah.
The golden camellia that Paulette is searching for, is that a true myth?
I wouldn't say it's a widespread myth, but there is a reference to it in a Chinese botanical text. I was reading a book about a Chinese scientific thought, and I came across it. There's the Duke of Kang, who wrote a very, very extended description of nature where he talks of this.
And at that point, had you begun writing the book, or was that before?
No, that I was very well into the book. You know, often these things are, as you say, serendipitous, and, you know, things. You know, a book is a very big thing, and it consists of lots of little moving parts, you know. It's impossible to sit down right in the beginning and excogitate all of it. You know, it happens incrementally. Every day there's a little addition.
When you're reading and writing about free trade in the 1830s, and then you're going to occupy Seattle, occupy Wall Street, and realize nothing has changed, what does that do? I mean, does that give you any hope for the future? Does that depress you?
Look, at this point in time, it's perfectly self-evident that everything that we've thought about economics is kind of fundamentally misplaced. Because even, say, economists who I really admire and follow, like Paul Krugman, they're still talking about growth. And it's perfectly clear that we can't grow our way out of the problems ahead. Growth is not the answer. Growth is the problem. So, yes, it does make me very, very depressed. I look at the American world, and it seems to me it would be literally impossible for anybody to tell the American public at large that what lies ahead is not growth but shrinkage, that you're going to become smaller. Your expectations, and material expectations, are going to become smaller. if you've built your whole life around, you know, material expectations, then that becomes a very hard message. So I do feel depressed about that. On the other hand, when I go to these Occupy demonstrations, this is very clear that these kids understand this. You know, they're not talking about, increase our salaries or give us this or give us that. They understand very clearly that the critical nature of what is ahead. That is, to me, I must say, what is really revelatory about that. Because, you know, especially for someone like me, you know, for years and years reading about this free trade stuff and all this, I felt like a complete voice in the wilderness. People think of it as an odd curiosity at best that I should be saying these things. But now, I mean, you know, I go there and I feel a sense of vindication that at last people understand the depth and seriousness of the issue.
Amitav Ghosh, did you always want to be a writer?
Yes, absolutely. I never wanted to be anything else.
And you read Sabatini as a kid, and you read Thornton Wilder?
I was a voracious reader, yes. I read and read and read.
Did you read a lot of science fiction?
A lot of science fiction. I love science fiction. And, you know, one of my books won the Arthur C. Clarke Award.
Which one was it?
It's a book called The Calcutta Chromosome. And I actually met Arthur C. Clarke, and we spent a long time talking.
You went down to Sri Lanka.
I was in Sri Lanka for a lecture, and suddenly what should happen, but a car draws up, and it's Arthur C. Clarke, and he says, well, you must come and visit me in my house. So off I went to see him at his house, and it was this amazing house. It was in a sort of very posh suburb of Colombo, and outside there was this gigantic satellite dish. Then you walked into his house, and it's plastered with signed pictures of all the world's greatest celebrities, you know. The most famous people in the world had been, he knew them. While I was sitting there, the Admiral of the Seventh Fleet called him. And, you know, you could see he was like, he was in his late 70s or early 80s. He was in a wheelchair, but he was a man just filled with fun and laughter. And then he wanted to play table tennis. So I said, okay, and he took me to this club, and he got out of his wheelchair, and then he told me his rules. His rules were that he got to play on half the table, and you had to play on the full table. You know, I mean, there he was inventing all this stuff.
Who won?
I think I managed to pull it out, but it was touch and go.
You beat Arthur C. Clarke in table tennis.
I did.
Well, in terms of learning how to be a writer, did you go to any writing classes, any writing schools?
No, never. I've never been to a writing class in my life.
How did your first book come about? You just wrote it and sent it in?
Yes, I had some kind of sort of sinecure sort of job, a one-year sort of fellowship, and I just sat down and wrote the first draft, and it was terrible, and I had to throw it all out and start all over again. I sent 7 or 8 chapters to a friend of mine in England who had ended up in a literary agency, and he wrote back and said, I love it.
And what year was that?
This was 1985.
So this was, apparently you became kind of radicalized in the 70s when Indira Gandhi had her state of emergency, so your politics were pretty much set by then.
No, I wouldn't say I was radicalized. It was a moment of great political turmoil, and I was working then for a major newspaper. But, you know, I'm not a sort of very ideological person, really. I think of myself more as a sort of observer. I never felt that I wanted to be, as it were, an activist or involved in politics in that way. But at that moment in time, it was an eye-opening kind of thing, you know.
As a writer, particularly a writer of fiction, which, you know, a lot of people don't quite understand, but as a writer of fiction, you can influence people politically that people who write newspapers cannot. People who give speeches cannot, because you could come in through the back door.
I think as a writer, if that was what you were trying to do, you would lose your readership very fast, because readers are extremely intelligent, you know. They know if you're trying to manipulate them into a point of view. See, what is interesting to me about the novel as a form, it's the reason why I'm not a journalist, why I'm not an academic. It allows you to explore contrasting points of view, you know. And that's what really interests me, because it's not like I know the answer. I really don't, you know, to most of the things. So what interests me is, say, even with opium, is to explore, you know, the ways in which a guy who's actually selling opium, like Bahram, how does he construct his world? In some general sense, I would not find myself on the same side of any situation as Bahram. And yet I can completely empathize with him and understand him. And that, to me, is the real miracle of the novel as a form, that it allows you to to explore these things from multiple points of view. You know, people who are straightforwardly villainous, and the world is filled with, villainous people, people who are really evil, I find that they're not that interesting for me to write about. I can't stay with them for that long. I mean, what interests me is exactly this, the characters who are filled with these moral ambiguities, you know, who are filled with doubts and uncertainties. It's not that simple to just stand back and pass judgment, as it were. You know, it's a very, very complex reality. And again, as I say, that's why I write fiction, because fiction allows me to explore these things in a kind of, you know, the multiplicity of it, the ambiguities.
Well, how did it feel then writing your memoir about a part of your life in an antique land?
That was a very, very difficult book to write. It was really, in some ways, it was a completely wrenching book to write, you know, to explore this, my life in this village, and to explore these other histories. I started writing in an antique land, I think it was in 1988, 89. And at that point, in India, we lived through a completely traumatic decade. You know, the 1980s in India were a decade of complete trauma. There were these terrible riots, there were these appalling insurgencies, and we lived surrounded by violence all the time. So, yeah, I was trying to come to terms with all of that.
Amitav Ghosh, moving on from River of Smoke, do you have a title for the next book?
Not yet, no.
Am I correct in assuming that we're going to follow the adventures of Zachary Reed from the first book and Joe Doo and some of the other characters on their way to Canton, or don't you know that yet?
To be honest, Richard, I really do not know. I really do not know. I mean, as I said, I mean, every book is its own adventure. And I don't think one can dictate to it and say, this is what you must be. You know, I mean, they have their own minds and they decide.
But I assume we'll see what happens to Zachary.
Yes. I'd be interested to find out what happens to Zachary.
Is that kind of how it begins? What the hell happened? Now I have to figure it out?
Yes. Yes. Often that's a part of it, yeah.
How much of that is conscious and how much of that just flows?
You know, it's really weird. I mean, sometimes I think, you know, I'll set myself 7 or 8 days when I'll just sit down and think about, you know, what happens. And I sit there and thinking and there's nothing comes to me. And then yesterday, you know, I was just lying in bed and it was a long, difficult day of racing from one thing to another. And suddenly in the morning I began to, so many ideas just came flooding into my head. I've been doing this all my life, and I still don't know how it happens.
You've been listening to an interview with Amitav Ghosh, whose latest book is River of Smoke. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.